This episode, I'm joined once again by Aaron French to discuss the work and mysticism of Jacob Burma. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my paying patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you would like to support the podcast and keep everything running, please find links in the description below. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, Aaron French, thanks once again for joining me on Hermetics Podcast.
Thanks for having me back again.
We are going to loosely, but mostly focusing on the work of Jacob Burma, who was a German philosopher, a Christian mystic, and arguably, though I'm sure not everyone would agree with this, a Lutheran theologian. But that's, you know, certainly up for debate considering his sort of controversial status. Considered very, you know, original in his day, known for certain books, but mostly I think for a book called Aurora. Lots of scandals around him in the day as well. And this is, he is born 1575, dies 1624. So you were pointing out before we started recording, this year in November will be the 400th anniversary of his death. So yeah, Aaron, Jacob Burma, what interests you so much about his work? And when did you sort of first, you know, find you had this interest?
Well, just being interested, I suppose, in the history of Western esotericism, it's rather impossible to ignore someone like him. But he's also, I think, as we'll talk about here, he's a bit difficult to penetrate and to absorb how he's important. You know, perhaps it's becoming more easier these days as more people are focusing on him more and in different ways. But even then, he's so inscrutable, I suppose. Like, even the way he talks and thinks and expresses his ideas, they're like fully in line with different forms of esotericism. Like in my case, this Christian esotericism in the Central European lands, but not only there, but I was focusing on there. He's extremely important, and he's like in some ways a founding figure in the modern stream of that. So he was always in the background in these later, like, occult and esoteric thinkers that I was interested in. But, you know, you have to, it takes a kind of journey from their time, like the time of the Theosophists, for example, who were all interested in Burma, to journey from their time back to Jacob Burma's time and to read what he was saying. It's really interesting, but it's a kind of a journey because it's a different context. And yet the ideas are very similar. So, I mean, it's not necessarily like a philosophical continuity, I suppose, but it is. They're definitely working with similar religious themes, which are in this category that we're using of esotericism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so, one of the things that's intriguing about Burma, and I mentioned it now. I mean, some of the things you sent me to sort of read and also watch about Burma, one of the things that was emphasized is, I mean, his education, he's not necessarily an educated man. I mean, he has a very, very basic education, which for his day probably would have been rare anyway. And then after this mystical divine experience, which isn't probably what people will imagine, he then begins to educate himself more via finding text. But he's before that, he's just an average, seems like he's pretty much an average Joe, really.
He's an average Johann. yeah, it's interesting about that point that he's self-educated, because again, if I'm with those modern, you know, moderns, like when I'm looking at the esotericists that I'm writing about in my academic research, are usually end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. But even there, many of them were also self-educated. Mm-hmm. So this is an interesting part. They're autodidacts, you know, like Manly P. Hall is like a great example of that. Like he wrote these massive books. Many like Masonic historians also were, and it's just self-taught somehow and self-trained on how to research. And like, of course, that's definitely was and has been a criticism against esotericism by the academic establishment for a long time, especially in the 20th century. Now it's a bit, people are opening up to, it's just a different way of doing it. Maybe they have good ideas. You know, there's like some flexibility emerging these days. But the self-educated part is important. And in fact, he was trained as a shoemaker, as a cobbler. And so that's a form of education. I mean, that's what's important. It's just not this like gymnasium literary whatever, learn some Latin stuff. He was trained in a trade, you know, as a kind of trade, a craftsman, so to speak. So, yeah. And then, so this theme of being an autodidact is also one you find in esoteric thinkers. I mean, you could argue that some of the academic training, I think academics know this, some of them to a certain extent, and when some of these like post-structuralists, I think were aware of this, that the academic training, in fact, blocks you from inspiration and certain kind of newness, you know, apprehending a new kind of idea, a new theory. Like the training is set up to you know, persuade you not to do that the whole time. So, but if you're an autodidact, you don't care. You're just going to go for it always, you know? And so you do arrive in new, even philosophical, spiritual landscapes because of that, I think. So like the post-structuralists, I think were to some extent aware of that and just trying to like shoot out beyond the way they were trained. But of course, they still had the training originally, whereas Jakob Burma had none of this kind of training. He wasn't a theologian either or anything like that, you know?
Yeah, but that's what I was going to add in. I mean, this is something we mentioned in our Esoteric Christianity course, which we can plug, but that someone else to bring in, I mean, who's along these lines in a way, Meister Eckhart is someone who, you know, completely gets this formal Dominican training and is completely, you know, is writing manuals for Dominicans to read. And what you mentioned there about this is like two paths of what happens when you have an experience or have an understanding that you've come to, which butts heads with formal training. So Meister Eckhart, we, you know, as we historically know, though it's a bit overblown, is all constantly at odds trying to find ways to have his own personal understanding be in line with official dogmatic teaching, whereas someone such as Jakob Burma, well, that you know, you don't become as apprehensive. But of course, as we know, he does get in some hot water as is imagined.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's really interesting to think about, okay, what is he trying to do? You know, like, what is, if a person like this, like Jakob Burma, and maybe we should all talk about his life a little bit here too, but his motivation is purely, it's twofold. It's on the one hand, it's purely spiritual or religious. You know, he feels, in other words, it's not to get any kind of position or anything, or not even to uphold necessarily some kind of a dogma or save souls. I don't even think that's like what it's like, purely his own, need based on his spirituality. That's like one half. And on the other half, he has these visions, you know, so these two elements of his life are his motivation, which, yeah, it's just a different kind of motivation. The thing is, you do then want, like many mystics do want to then communicate these experiences. And then you do get, I don't know, like followers, like even Jakob Burma had followers, even in his time. And this is like another subject of like, okay, this is a reason why many esotericists were also not taken seriously by the quote unquote establishment, because it's like, oh, what if they have these followers in quotes? So it's like, well, they're just trying to get, then it seems like it's an ego trip, or it can be even framed that way, something like this, you know. But just to say a little bit about him, more about his background, and we'll come to these mystical experiences that he had. So as you mentioned, he was born right in this period where the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation was taking place. So there was a lot of conflict over religious ideas. He was born in a small village. But then he moved to a town called Görlitz, which is now where he's known. You know, if you go to Görlitz, that's where his legacy is, so to speak, and his museum and so on. He bought a house there. He got married there and had children. Then he set up his own cobbler's shop, and that's like what his life was going to be. You know, he was trained to, he had two options, to become a farmer or not. And so he said not. And then you can't then become a theologian necessarily if you know, if those are your options, to be a farmer or not. So then he became shoemaker. But in Görlitz, though, I think this is part of the important part of his story, because this was a very interesting place at the time. It was right on the border between modern day Germany and modern day Poland. So you had the Lutheran influence in the states of Saxony, which is what is now Saxony and Brandenburg in Germany, and then the other side you had the Habsburg Bohemia. I mean, it was essentially part of Bohemia at the time, but it was like right on the border between these groups. And even in Bohemia, you had Calvinist groups that were like popping up and being suppressed and so on. So, you know, he's like right in between these two things. Another interesting part about this area, it's also known as Lusatia. And there's a group of, it's like, it's in Germany at this point, but there's a group of indigenous Slavic peoples also that are from this area, and they're still around. They're called the Sorbs, and they speak a language which is more closely related to like Czech or Slovak or Polish or something. And they have customs that look like they're coming out of a Slavic context, you know, like traditional folk kind of things. And they're still in that area in Gorlitz and so on, and still preserve some of their language. So this is also part of like this context. He's in a very like hybrid kind of context between quote unquote East and West, in East and West Europe or something at this point. And then the other reason why it's important that he's there is because Bohemia and Prague, this is the time of Rudolf II in Prague, who was Prague was basically like esoteric Disneyland at this point. So you had all sorts of alchemists and Kabbalists and magicians and so on and astrologers there. Mm. And because Gorlitz was positioned where it was, there was kind of like a nexus of all of these influences. You had these kind of Lutheran, Catholic, but also Kabbalistic and alchemical influences, and these like traditional Slavic even kind of cultural influences. So it's a real like real mixed environment that he was encountering. And you have to think too that this is not a trained person, as we've been talking about. So if you take a small town boy or something like that and stick him in that kind of environment, you know, he's very open. Mm. So I think he was quite receptive to all of these things and responded in a receptive, open way, not with cynical criticism, which is the way a trained person would normally respond to it, is what I mean. He had this kind of open reaction to it and then responded emotionally, you know, with his life and with his spirituality. So he was there, just to continue here a little bit more. He was there as a cobbler, and then he was always, we can get into this later if you want, about like what's mythical about his life and what's real, but he supposedly was always kind of sensitive, had spiritual experiences of a kind, like even when he was young. But then, famously, in 1600, he had this big mystical experience, and it's first reported by his biographer. Well, the full account that we have was reported by his biographer, Abraham von Frankenberg. Burma also talks about it, but you have like different accounts of what it is. But generally speaking, he's in his cobbler's shop, and he sees the light reflected off of a metal dish. Mm. And in response to this seemingly mundane occurrence, observation, he has like a breakthrough in terms of like the nature of reality, the nature of light and darkness, and so on. And he himself later claimed that this lasted like an hour. He then like wandered out outside and was like looking at the grass and the light and having this like profound download, essentially. And then he didn't do it. He just like lived with this experience, it was apparent according to the biography, for 12 years. And then after 12 years, he produced his first work, which wasn't actually published per se, but it was, he wrote it. And this is the book Aurora. And as far as I know, I don't think it was published. The only like officially published book in his lifetime was The Way to Christ. Mm-hmm. Could be wrong here, but I mean, he did write these things and they were kind of circulated, you know? Mm. And this book Aurora, for example, was somehow the Lutheran minister in Gorlitz got his hands on a copy of it and freaked out. And with the support of the city council, they ordered Burma to stop writing anymore on the grounds of heresy. Mm. And so he did.
We should add in there as well, on the grounds of heresy, that, you know, it's around this time, quite literally, mm-hmm. that one Giordano Bruno has just been burned at the stake for heresy as well. So this is it's not a small deal.
Right, so it was a hot topic, and they were looking, and he could the punishments would have been known, you know, to if you continue along that road, and so he did stop, but he didn't stop for good. He kept writing, I think, in secret, and he completed a second book in 1619, and then this is right around the time when the 30 Years' War starts, and just to wrap up this section, that he. This is the Reformation, Counter-Reformation. Now he's in the 30 Years' War with these groups fighting. And so this was a horrible, one of the most horrible wars in European history. And so he's like witnessing all of this. And it's interesting that, as I mentioned, he's responding to it in this emotional, like philosophical way, open way. And so he seems like somehow, I think he got it. You know, he seems well positioned to suddenly grasp this conflict between polarities. Mm. You know, that's the way he took it into his spirituality, into his philosophy. And this symbolism of light and darkness then, or polarity, becomes super strong in his cosmology and his system.
So one thing I was going to ask though, I mean, clearly there's not going to be too many direct influences because his mystical writing comes from, I think I'm right in thinking the only book he read for a long time was literally just the Bible. So that the influence is just going to be scriptural until later on. But was he a notably spiritual person prior to these experiences?
Yeah, I mean, in the sense of like the small town Johann is a spiritual type of guy, religious guy. Mm. He must have been reading the Bible in German now that we're thinking about this, because this is after Luther. So Luther has now done his deed, and so the Bible can be read in German. The other thing about Jakob Böhme is he was one of the first to... Hegel called him the first German philosopher because, yeah, he's reading the German Bible, and then he writes his philosophy in German. So the establishment people would have been writing it all in Latin. So he's one of the first ones to now writing it in German. So Hegel refers to him at some point, and other people do as well, as like the German philosopher, because like in the same way as Luther, we could say he's now writing it in German rather than in Latin. But so he was influenced by Luther, and Luther was, of course, known to be a kind of anti-mystic. But Luther did have a sympathy for Bernard of Clairvaux, actually, so he wasn't like fully against it. He was kind of in the middle, I suppose. But some other influences, like because he's just reading the Bible, then he has his experiences and then he's writing, and he's not citing any sources really in this. He's just like expressing himself, you know. It is hard to track down, like, where is he getting this, you know? And this is, again, the same with later esotericists. Like, just off the top of my head, if I rattle off the modern ones, like Manly P. Hall, well, even like, what's his name? Elvis Levy, Manly P. Hall, Albert Pike, Rudolf Steiner. I mean, all these people have all of these things that they've, quote unquote, written. Mm. Even, you know, Blavatsky does cite a lot of her work, actually. Maybe we give her some credit. Maybe God knows what she's citing, but it's interesting that she does cite a lot of her sources, you know. But at the same time, she's saying, this part I got from this guy who's wrong. But here, from this spiritual being, I get this other information, which is right, you know. So she's still pulling on some non-textual way of doing it.
Well, just to draw on that, actually, I mean, a lot of those writers, even though we don't know where they got it from, they will have their signifier for the place or the thing, so where it apparently came from. So with Blavatsky, it's the masters, right? That is it, the Tibetan masters. With Steiner, it'd be the Akashic Chronicles. With someone like Gurdjieff, maybe he found some scrolls in the desert, which no one has ever found, etc., etc. There isn't any, you know, Böhme. Would he just say God?
Well, this is interesting. Actually, I'm glad you're asking this, because there's a part of this I wanted to talk about, which is sort of like a mythical part, you know. But I like it. I think it's cool and interesting because, like, so the academics try to track down historians. Where is he getting his ideas from, you know? And with sticking with that context, it's clear that he was influenced. It's just not clear how much by the Kabbalah. And he references the Kabbalah at a few points. So we know he, like, knows about it. And how could he not know about it? Of course he knows about it. So it's just not, he's like saying, and in the Zohar, and then this, and then makes a footnote. You know, he just doesn't do it that way. But he does mention the Kabbalah by name a few times. We know he also used concepts from Paracelsus a lot. And people around him were connected to other people at the time who were like, you know, proto-Christian theosophists or like Lutheran mystics of a kind. So like he also read and from his, one of his supporters was also in correspondence with this person, Valentin Weigel, who was another like Lutheran mystic, you know, kind of we get into this later, the pan-sophist, like a Sophianist within this Lutheran context. And also Caspar Schwenkfeld, he was another one of these reformer mystical, they kind of set up like Bruderschaft or like a Gemeinde. So you get like someone with this really intense spiritual, in the German context, I mean, you get like someone with a really intense German, or not German, sorry, an intense spirituality or inner spiritual experience, and then they get like a group around them, you know? And sometimes they operate in secret, not so much for esoteric purposes, but sometimes, but for the reasons that you were talking about, because like you get in a lot of trouble, you know? Mm-hmm. So these are a part of his influence. And another person, and here's the fun mythical part, is that he probably knew about the sermons of Johannes Tauler. And there's this other book called the Theologia Germanica, which is like a mystical treatise from the Middle Ages. It's just called the German Theology in the English translation. This is thought to have been written by like a member of this Teutonic order. Mm. And so around the same time as, I mean, Johannes Tauler was important, and he was connected to this Teutonic order to a certain extent, like the people around it at this time. And so there's a famous, here's the mythical part, which the Theosophists do connect Burma to this, that in the tradition of like German Christian, German Christian esotericism or Christian Theosophy comes to be known as this later. There's this story or like legend about someone, or quasi legend about someone called the Friend of God from Oberland, and in German it's Der Gottesfreund vom Oberland, and this is a mysterious figure in the history of German mysticism in the Middle Ages, and he was associated with a group who called themselves the Friends of God. That was it, and this figure, this person calling himself the Friend of God. From upper land in English, I suppose. This person was involved in teaching or working with Johannes Tauler on his own mystical expression and his own mystical teachings, like refining them for him, and also like correcting him according to the story where he was going astray at certain points in his like his sermons and his beliefs, you know, his own personal beliefs. And so Tauler and these Gottesfreunde, they are working together at this period, according to this story, their whole mission is to promote this idea that there's an interconnection between the believer and God, and that this is actually this relationship is actually more important than external practices. And they even set up a kind of monastery in the wilderness around the town of Strasbourg. So this is all happening in that area. But I have one quote here about this. And this is from Franz Hartmann, so famous theosophist. And he has a book called The Life of a Christian Philosopher. So I'm just going to read this little short passage from this. Burma, had another unusual experience when he worked in the shoemaker shop, and an unknown stranger entered and asked Burma to come outside. When he went out in the street, the stranger looked into his eyes and said, "Jakob, you are now little, but you will become a great man, and the world will wonder about you. Be pious, live in the fear of God, and honor his word. Especially do I admonish you to read the Bible. Herein you will find comfort and consolation, and you will have to suffer a great deal of trouble, poverty, and persecution. Nevertheless, do not fear, but remain firm. God loves you and is gracious to you," end quote. So it's interesting because within this context of this German theosophy, there's a Rosicrucian connection here, which is what I want to point out, that even many of these people have a story like this. Like Johannes Tauler has his mysterious figure that he meets, the Friend of God. Burma has, if we believe these legends, has this kind of a story. Steiner has this story about meeting a quote-unquote master, these Rosicrucian masters. So I haven't been able to find out where these stories coming from. I suppose if someone knows, they could give us more information about this. But the Theosophists did bring him into this kind of tradition. And it's a tradition of like hidden Rosicrucian masters contacting people in order to, you know, in order to like continue the project, continue the mission. And the Theosophists, of course, would take this Rosicrucian stream back to these Teutonic Knights, back to the Templars, and this kind of other Christianity. So I just wanted to mention that story because it's kind of interesting that this story about meeting a master that according to Franz Harman, at least, Burma also had some experience like this.
Mm-hmm. So to jump into his thought, his work, and I guess from these, from this first mystical experience that he has with the jar and the light, it seems that the primary problem that he's seeing and tackling, or the primary thing he wants to maybe resolve, or is resolved in a way, or is attempted to be resolved, is the question of theodicy, right? Why is there so much evil and suffering in the world, which of course is going to be rife in his own life with respect to the war and probably not the best living standards. I believe he's pretty poor for a while, has to move to a different district and things like this. So this is, would you say this is the central question of his work, of how to reconcile evil with a loving God?
Yeah, I would say so. It is the main project, but I don't know. There's like another thing that he's definitely big keen on, and that is like merging with, I mean, they're connected. So like to merge with God is connected to the problem of evil. So he's definitely really interested in this, like what I would call it is this chemical idea of the chemical wedding, like this in the Rhodes, speaking from within the Rosicrucian philosophies, like he's definitely interested in that for sure. But he's also interested in the problem of evil, the theodicy issue, but they're kind of both related for him. And he relates them in very interesting ways by coming up with all sorts of new, basically philosophical ideas and making a system to resolve these things in order to bring those two things together. But yeah, as you mentioned, like this problem of good and evil, it's definitely in response to, I think, what he's seeing around him. You know, but it's also, I imagine it's in response to his own, like he has a book that one of the books I'd recommend people to check out is called Confessions. So he does talk about his own, like there's this external social context of the war, but he has his own struggles about this. So it's definitely, that's a motivating factor, like how to stop the, like the evil will, the self, what he calls like the self will within himself. Like this is his main goal, is I have to like the lowercase s self, the will of this self, is the thing that is responsible for evil. And so we all have this, but this will of this self will, he relates to like the Lucifer, he takes it back in the fall of the rebel angels, that this is like the beginning of this idea. And so that the individual must have submit this smaller will to a higher will. And in the process of doing that, which is not easy, obviously. and so, but if you can do it, this obliterates the smaller s self will, lowercase s. And the, but in this, for the sake of this capital S self, this higher self, but it, the process of doing that obliterates the smaller self, but it doesn't just mean you become the higher self. Like the way he talks about it is that this actually, it makes something new. So the process of doing that is the moment of rebirth. And you then are like a new being, what he calls the unified union with God. So in German, it's die einige Einigung. So you are like this single unified, it gives birth to this single unified being. So it isn't necessary. I think why he spends so much time thinking in this way, because it isn't just like you just bow down and submit or something, or you remove yourself and replace it with it isn't and replace it with God or something, God's will. It's not exactly that. Like you do that, but then that creates like a new being, a new creature. And yeah, so it's this inner struggle, which he's doing within himself and talking about, but I think he sees it playing out in the conflicts in his around in the world around him as well.
Can that once after post unification, when you become this being, can that small s self return, or are you perfect evermore?
No, yeah, I think that's the end of it. But I think the struggle continues. Like, I mean, that's a good question because it's not really clear. But he does say that if you really do it, yeah, then you're. Well, this is a good question because, like, for example, he talks about in the book of Revelation, you know, in these like the end times, that human beings will have done that, you know, that so that they will be. And the one thing I should bring in here is how he's talking about it is in terms of polarity again. Mm-hmm. I mean, for him personally, like, he doesn't claim to have done that, even though he's writing all of these books, you know. So he claims to, of course, have some kind of illuminations, but then he also claims to just be continuously locked in this struggle. So I suppose for him, maybe it's true that it's just a struggle the whole time, but there is like an objective, you know, and it is also possible. Like, I have this one quote I wanted to read here from his confessions, where he's talking about this, and he says, this is a quote from Burma about this inner battle. He says, "I am a sinful and mortal man as well as thou, and I must every day and every hour grapple, struggle, and fight with the devil who afflicts me in my corrupted, lost nature, in the wrathful power which is in my flesh, and in all men continually. Suddenly I get the better of him. Suddenly he is too hard for me. Yet notwithstanding, he has not overcome or conquered me, though he often gets the advantage over me. If he buffets me, then I must retire and give back. But the divine power helps me again. Then he also receives a blow, and often loses the day in the fight. But when he is overcome, when the heavenly gate opens in my spirit, and then the spirit sees the divine and heavenly being, not externally beyond the body, but in the wellspring of the heart." I mean, he does kind of claim that that's what happens in this moment, you know, because leading up to this big mystical experience he had, he was struggling over this theodicy problem inwardly, you know, and so in this sense, the heavenly gates opened. I mean, he does put it that way in another place,
mm-hmm.
but I think he's then also back to the struggle. So
this is why I asked that question about whether or not it could return, because from my own readings, it seems like Burma's philosophy and theology, if we wanted to call it that, is very processual. Like, it's everything is ongoing. Reminded me really of like an Ouroboros, right? Like, you're within this thing that is ever ongoing, and both sides of that ongoing process are always needed to keep it going. And there's not going to be this, which is kind of very much against the dogmatics of Christianity, which is very fond of like hard stops at certain points. That's why Oregon got in trouble as well. But really what I'm talking about there is, you know, when he has this first mystical experience with the light going into this sort of dark vase, he has this realization that the light can only exist because of the dark, or we only can understand evil because we understand good, and vice versa. And so both of these things are sort of always needed for any understanding of either of them to be at all. And so it almost seems for Burma like the problem of evil doesn't really get a resolution. You know, it's not like we're going to get rid of evil, because there's this, there's a basically an internal requirement within good for there to be evil at all. And so that's where it gets a bit complicated. But am I somewhat right along those lines?
Yeah, no, you are for sure. And there's more to say about this too, about it definitely strikes me as well as a kind of process, you know, process theology or something like, but it's also dialectical. And that's why, you know, even Hegel is interested in him, that this notion of polarities and dialectical creation or dialectical processes, like ongoing, you know, that's also distinct in the German tradition of philosophy and romanticism and so on as well. So it's interesting that he is also working with that. And he does take this position that evil is not created by God, but that it's part of what you just said, that it's part of this dialectical process, that the one is needed. And it gets really unusual when you read the way he tries to like explain this stuff, or it kind of spins your head around, you know, because he says like the world of darkness or evil or wrath or whatever is required for the world of light, but it's out of those two worlds that this third world appears, or this third being appears. And so it is a kind of process, but there is like a result, you know, in the being out of it. But I do think that you're right, that the struggle also continues, but it's within this twofold into the three that allows for, like, you know, he says this is how the Trinity is reflected in nature for as well, you know. So it's that process is essential for the kind of like the union, this chemical marriage with God. But you have to struggle through that process, through what I just described, to come to this higher understanding or this higher position, you know.
So where does Jesus fit into this? Because you mentioned the Trinity, and so, you know, two into the third. Seems like that might be the position that Christ is fulfilling, because, once again, if my memory serves me well, one of Burma's more controversial ideas, really, with respect to this Trinity idea, is that God the Father isn't really, like, fully God. That's not Burma's words, but he isn't. Like, it's Jesus. Christ is the more central figure, like, which... I don't know if this is right, so this is just me speaking, but Burma's appreciation of the Trinity appeared to me as if it was not, you know, there's the classic Jesus is God, the Father is God, the Holy Spirit is all God. There didn't seem to be this equal relationship for Burma, in that they eventually get to Christ, who is, as you said, like, well, you didn't say, but there is this point of resolution. And is that where Christ comes in?
Yeah, and this point of resolution is... you know, is the Christ in you. Mm. So, like, I don't think he would say that, but I'm sure people could say that. Like, he has the Trinity, he has all of these elements involved, but he definitely, like all the Pietists and these German mystics, this inner Christ component is massive. So it does receive definitely more emphasis. But I would say more where he gets into trouble, which we can come to, is the role of Sophia, which suddenly does shift it from your normal three to a four, sort of, and we can come back to that. But one thing just to talk about this this threefold thing, how he's looking at it, he has this concept of the three principles. Like, this number three is important for him, and he has the three worlds. He also, like, has this rereading of the book of Genesis that I just wanted to talk about. So he, in his reading of the book of Genesis, you have Adam, the first human, which is like the reflection of the divine, created, though, of the quintessence or the prima materia. Mm. So you'll see him drawing on these Paracelsian and alchemical ideas here as well. So Adam is composed of the quintessence, but through his own self-will, this lowercase s self-will, he rejects through the use of that will, the desiring of that will, he rejects his union with God. Mm-hmm. And at this point, this is what Burma calls this the first fall. At this point, Sophia is taken from him. So, in other words, this original Adam being was androgynous, in that it was the Sophia, the wisdom was in there. Mm-hmm. But when he has this first fall, the Sophia is taken away, and God replaces it with Eva. And this is a woman. But it's still one being at this point.
Okay. I'm with you.
Okay, but then they taste the fruit of knowledge. Yeah. And this is the second fall. And then they become two separate gendered beings at this point. And this is the problem of duality. This is where evil is brought in. And of course, like, there's this idea that Carl Jung talked about a lot, about the binarius, which is this so-called spirit of this kind of dragon spirit of duality. And as other alchemists in this tradition also talked about the binarius as being like the when you bring in this duality, this is evil in the world. So you have to resolve this in order to get rid of evil. And Burma is on the same page. And so when you go through this process that I mentioned about the struggling to give up to the higher will, and then something else is reborn, what is reborn is the Christ part of you. But it's only that whole process is only possible with the Sophia, with wisdom. Mm. So in fact, this third position that you arrive in is the reunification of the polarity, the two genders. The Christ and the Sophia are married again within you. And he does say, like, when as I mentioned in the book of Revelation, he says that humans will regain their bodies without gender at this point. Because it's this process of the break into the gendered. You find this in a lot of Gnostic books as well. I mean, this is kind of Gnostic in a certain, I guess, in a way, what I'm talking about here. But I don't know that Burma was thinking about it in that way, or if he had access to those ideas. But so the polarity of the two genders is the origin of evil. The reunification of the two genders in the form of Christ and Sophia is the reconciliation of that.
It's a full cycle all the way around. Now, what's interesting about that cycle is, you know, unlike, you know, if we were to say Catholic theology, which is faith-based, faith and works, sorry. Oh, and then if you were to go through to, you know, something like Calvin, which is like double predestination, you're already chosen, and all of these different theologies, which have a very complex theological understanding as to what the role of God is with regards to one's individual salvation, almost seems for Burma like that whole thing has been, I don't want to say severed, but I'll use that word because it's what came to mind, you know, severed away. And it's like the onus is on you to use what is available for this reunification. I'm asking. So we have the inner Christ, but all the while I'm like, where's God? You know, where's God in this?
Yeah. Well, and it's a good question, because there is a kind of back, one could see a sort of God taking the back seat in all of this. And not only does the Christ sit in the front seat more, but also Sophia is probably in the driver's seat. So you do have this shifting going on, which is why I think that there are these problems of heresy sometimes and so on. And so this tradition of the Sophia, though, like all of this stuff, like the, using the Kabbalah, using alchemy, using astrology, which he's using all of these. Again, it's interesting to think about him as being, you know, from the small village and encountering all these ideas and then just like putting them into the Bible that he was reading. You know, he's not trained to keep them out per se. He's just like going for it with all of these things. So I think that those ideas are behind it, like underlying it, you know, and that does then change the form of it, from opposed to if you're just learning systematic theology, you know, or something like that, you would, you would get this model, you know, you get this form. And he's doing a much more like, it's more artsy in some way, you know, he's kind of painting with it, but he's also thinking, you know, so it's like, this is again, part of this German, history of German philosophy quality of this, like art and philosophy, it's kind of holistic, you know, thing that it's known for. So there's a, yeah, he's doing philosophy and to some extent, but he's also doing a kind of creative activity, I think, like a kind of art. When I was talking about this, Adam, two falls of Adam, he says, this is an interesting quote from Burma. He says, Adam reflected the Trinity in paradise, but he fell asleep. He slept as one, but woke as two. He slept to eternal being and woke to the elemental existence in which he came to know good and evil. So again, he's talking about, he had the Sophia at first, but then he fell asleep, used his will, in other words, fell asleep to his own divine, to the divine, and then woke up as two separate beings. This is what it says.
What's really intriguing about that, the more I think about it, I mean, this notion of the two folds, right? So the first, the beginnings of everything of man as a entirely unified androgynous, well, sorry, not man, an androgynous perfect being.
Human. Yeah.
Human that includes Sophia and the whole of the non-duality to become the duality within it is within Eden, would be within Eden as I understand it. Then there is the first fall. But what's interesting there is Adam and Eve are still within Eden. So we, you know, so because Eden you're seen as losing, what's it called? You know, you can speak one-on-one with one-on-one and walk in the garden with God, but I can't remember. Right. There is a theological name for that divine something. I can't remember what it's called. But we lost something bigger before that. But what's interesting is we fell and we were still within Eden with that polarity, which supposes some fairly spicy theology with regards to it. If the very notion, you know, you're talking about Jung with, what's it called, the dragon?
Yeah, the binarius.
Binarius. Yeah. So I don't know that concept too well, but it seems like the very notion of polarity, fragmentation, duality itself is the, you know, is the evil, is the problem in itself. So you know, having this split that's still within Eden is a very strange, strange thing.
It is quite strange. And he even says something like, what was happening there was that then God was like testing them again. Like, okay, you did it once, and then I took away the Sophia, but will you do it again? You know, like,
we did actually get a we did get a second chance.
Something like that, yeah.
Oh, wow.
But then they did it again, and then, yeah.
So, just to draw on the Sophia thing, I mean, you said that with the Gnosticism thing, it's probably going to be very difficult to really trace
whether or not he'd read any of that, I guess, outside of any explicit statements. Because Sophia, I think for many people, Sophia is understood as, you know, the snuck-in spark of Sophia, which is allows us to return outside of the demiurge, the Gnostic demiurge world. Mm-hmm. What was Burma's relationship with the world? Did he have that kind of understanding, you know, that sort of Gnostic, also Neoplatonic, the world really is not where we should be, or was what's going on there?
No, I don't think so, actually. I mean, I think he's seeing it more in terms of like, I mean, it is a fallen state and a fallen nature, you know. I mean, he holds to that, but it's more about like returning. You find this in a lot of these esoteric Christianity systems of belief or ideas, that you have to return to the state prior to the fall. So it's not about getting out of this world, but it's in a weird way, first of all, transforming yourself. I mean, this is the alchemical part. He even refers to the Christ as the philosopher's stone in some places, because it transmutes humans from this lower state back into their perfect human state. Mm. And the same is actually true of the world. So it's more a process. This is why I'm into the Manichaean elements of this. Sometimes I go into that area because the way the Manichaean Christianity is read in this context, or way it's described, which is different from the, to some extent, different from the actual historical movement around Mani, but it's about this idea of transforming evil into good. So it is a processual activity, and it's that you transform evil into good from lower state into higher state. The world comes with you, though. You know, you don't leave this world, and in fact, you find some really extreme, interesting, a little bit later, by people who are more than likely also influenced by Burma, or people who had been influenced by Burma in France, in Central Europe. You find in these, like in Martinism and Pasquali and the Elukoan, and these other forms of Christian mysticism that are a bit later. There you find a huge emphasis on this return to the prelapsarian state. And that's like their main activity, but they're doing it through, you know, ritual magic. Mm. And so on. But they also have these ideas about, reckoning the world. So they think that their ritual magic not only transforms them, but it's going to crack the world and transmute it, you know, start the process of transmutation, the alchemical process, you know, which is a process of death and rebirth. So the world dies first and so on. So I guess all that to say, it's a bit different, I think, than just to escape in like a Neoplatonic sense, like escape the hell. There's this like transformative aspect to it as well.
Mm-hmm. So one more aspect to bring in just with his philosophy is the Ungrund, I believe it's pronounced. But what is this strange idea?
Well, if I could say, I'll come to that because it's related to Sophia. Maybe I could just say one more thing about the Sophia. So in this, I'm just going to call it Christian Theosophy, but scholars usually say Christian Theosophy starts with Jakob Burma, technically speaking. But there were like these friend of God idea that I mentioned, and there were other, and the Christian Kabbalah elements, there were the other things around that could be connected to it, in my opinion. And Sophia is there as part of it. Like when the Christian Kabbalists, sometimes Sophia and the Shekhinah are connected in this way. And Shekhinah in Judaism is the female side of God, but it's the way you reach God. It's the wisdom. So when the high priest would go into the temple to communicate with Yahweh, it would be through the Shekhinah is what would appear above the ark. So that's that's like the medium through which the wisdom is the medium through which someone can actually reach to the divine, to that level. And so you find this idea of being used with Sophia a lot as well. And some of these other, like, so there's another tradition, pan-Sophism, is kind of related to this, but there's an overlap here between Christian Theosophy and pan-Sophism. But the Sophia just takes on the central role as the way to God. And you had some of these thinkers, like, these are all a little bit after Burma, but not much. But in fact, they are like his legacy. Like, they were figuring out ways to evoke the Sophia, like as a spiritual being, you know, to how to merge themselves with it. Mm-hmm. But like, and even Steiner, much later, of course, is in the same group. And he says, there's a famous quote from Steiner where he said, "It is not the Christ we lack, but the Sophia of Christ that we lack." And his esoteric Christianity is built on the same idea that you have to somehow regain the Sophia in order to, not that you don't have the Christ, but you're like oblivious of it. You know, you're not conscious of it. So you have to, and this will come to the Ungrund with this unconscious thing. Like you can't know it. You know, you're somewhat like Zen Buddhism or something. Like you're already enlightened, but you just don't know it. You're ignorant. But the Sophia somehow is what allows you to become aware of it, you know? And Burma says also that Sophia is the mother in which the father works. Yeah, so these are all...
So the father's within the mother?
Yeah, or no, the Sophia is the mother in which... Yeah, something like that. So there's some kind of like reversals going on here. So you could see, I guess, why he's getting into trouble. But this is not just him speaking this way. Like, he's part of a larger... Some of it comes after him, as I said, but this is a kind of part, a larger, I guess, tradition we would call it. I don't know, like interest in using the Sophia in this way.
Yeah.
But to go to this idea of the Ungrund, what is this? This is like, he says he comes to this idea when he has these visionary experiences, I think. He calls it the fathomless, ineffable abyss of divinity. And what he says was, in this experience, I saw and knew the being of all beings. So it's this kind of like, you know, a cosmic abyss or something. But what's interesting about him is he talks about the ground of being, and then there's this groundless. There's the groundless, and there's the ground of being. And it's this groundless, this kind of nothingness, this abyss, you know, that he's... That's what the Ungrund is. But, you know, if you were to look at this idea more and track it through people like Schelling and von Hardman and then Freud and Jung, I mean, this leads to this idea of the unconscious in a certain sense. Or it's this is like the, you know, the background of it in a similar, you can watch it developing it, in other words, through like reading Burma. And it's not so different from some like the way Jung would maybe talk about it. But it is like this... It's the nothingness, but it's the abyss of nothingness in which the somethingness, in which the somethingness becomes aware it is a something. You, in other words, when you look into the abyss, you know, when you encounter the abyss, the nothingness, even Heidegger, I guess, a little bit talking about this in a very different way. But when you encounter the nothingness, the abyss, only in the abyss can you become aware that there is something. The nothing itself is, in other words, reaching for the something. And when you read him talking about this, it makes you laugh because of the way he has to say it. It sounds almost like it's kind of wordplay, you know, or something. I didn't bring a quote with me, but when you read it, it's like reading, you know, like a
complete tautology kind of thing.
Something. It's just a kind of... Yeah, cursive, yeah, cyclical kind of thinking, you know, that just spins your head around in a circle. But I think that's the point, you know. And even one place, he calls it kind of a Liebesspiel, a play of love. Like, he's kind of playing with these ideas. But like, for example, Kierkegaard said that the self is a self that relates itself to itself. And for Burma, it's something like this. It's like the self is an I that sees itself as an I staring back at itself. Mm. In this Ungrund, in this nothingness, and he also brings in the through this kind of process, this dialectical process. This is how the Trinity is reflected for him, also in nature. But the Sophia is also brought in here because he says that this Ungrund, this abyss, is only knowable through the Sophia, and he says that the Sophia is the virginal wisdom of the nothing. So it's The will of the nothing looks out in search of something. Like, he talks a lot about desire and craving. So, I mean, he's speaking abstractly, but you could just make this very literal and concrete that you are the nothing, you know, this small self will. The nothing looks out in desire in search of something, in light and love. And then you get a kind of self-revelation in the nothing, that there is a something. But then you draw this back to you. And if this could result then in a kind of union, a reconciliation of the opposites. So he does talk about this as a kind of Liebesspiel, as a love play. But it's the nothing knows itself as something, and this leads to like a knowledge of the eternal or something like that. It's pretty complicated. I'm not going to pretend like I fully understand what he's going on.
Well, I think it seems to be. I mean, it seems to the same inherent paradox seems to be mirrored in his approach of theodicy, right? Of good and evil, of what, okay, well, where does that sort of end sort of thing? Because you can't have good winning because good can only be defined, right? Like nothing can really come to a complete stop or a complete success or something akin to that idea, because if it did so, it would cease to exist because it doesn't have the contradistinction which it needs to exist. Same with being. It's this sort of recursive thing within which there seems to be nothing. But it seems maybe that within that paradox is some truth that he found, and that's the only way he could articulate it, maybe, for us.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of visual. In a certain sense, it's visual, the way he's working with it, with the idea of light and dark. Mm-hmm. You know, so he's getting a kind of visual... he's getting a kind of like a picture of something that he's then attempting to describe in words. The only other thing I would add about that is he does talk a lot about freedom. Mm-hmm. So it's sometimes referred to as der Ungrund der Freiheit. So it's also in this dialectical process in which the free will is the true freedom is attained, because in this the lower self being obliterated by the higher self, giving birth to this new Christ Sophia self, this is like the state of the true state of freedom again. So it's really similar to like later philosophers like Hegel, for example, just using it in a very different way. But the freed will is the will of God, but it's your will, it's united with the will of God. So it is a kind of like submission to God's will, you know, but it isn't that, you know, like he goes to great lengths to make it more than that in a certain sense.
Okay. I'll pretend like I'm not. So, I mean, maybe one question to ask, considering my own sort of befuddlement with that, is like, did you said he had some followers? I think he had like ardent readers who, without which, like monetary support, he probably would have been forgotten. Were there... Mm-hmm. Like maybe during his life, probably not during his life, but after his death, did societies or practice build on a communal level?
Yeah, well, he had like even in Gorlitz, he had people who supported his ideas, but then he had like these, I mean, it was the Lutheran pastors who were after him. So that's interesting to, you know, to think about. So yeah, the only book, as I mentioned, that I think was published in his life was The Way to Christ. But his papers were... taken, like, for example, this thing with the Lutheran priest and his supporters in the Tao, this didn't let up for his whole life. And in fact, the successor of the original pastor who was after him was there and on his deathbed, you know, grilling him about these crazy ideas and say, you know, before he was, whether or not he was going to make it, you know, when he died. So they didn't let up on this. But his papers or some of his papers or something were smuggled, because people were fleeing these areas, obviously, because now there's this war, you know. So and famously, Amsterdam became a place where many people fled religious persecution. So his books, some of his legacy ends up in Amsterdam, but like some people wrote biographies about him and then started publishing his books. A lot of these diagrams that you sometimes see with that are in Jakob Burma books, or if you just, you know, search his name or something, those aren't necessarily by him, but by some of these people some of them are people who are like illustrating and putting out his works after the fact. So yeah, after the fact, after his death, he did start to attain a much wider readership, and he influenced lots of people. I mean, for example, I had some interesting ones I wanted to mention here about that. Like, so one person he influenced was William Blake. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of see, in my opinion, a kind of a similarity even there between the two of them. And what is that similarity? Like, they're both very fiery. Like, it's the fire of the spirit. They have received something, and they're on fire to get it out there.
I don't think they've got anything to prove, though. You know what I mean? I don't think they have anything to prove. Like, they're just like, this thing happened and now I'm going to write about it, whatever.
Right. Yeah. They're not trying to like convince you or something. Yeah. Yeah. They're telling you, you know, they're shouting it out, and they're doing it in a very like, very vigorous and like intense. It's a kind of intense communication that they're in form of expression that they're using. So there are some differences between Blake and Burma, obviously, but there are a lot of similarities. So, and he was influenced by him, but also even like Milton and even Isaac Newton. So his ideas did become much more well known later. And then, as I mentioned, even the Theosophists are then picking him up. Mm-hmm. So continuously he was connected to these like esoteric currents.
Yeah.
So they were always taking an interest in him. You know, at this point, I'm not exactly sure. What I think he's still a bit, for example, I knew someone who was in Gorlitz and I just brought up Jakob Burma, someone who was from there. I met them somewhere else. And just to see if, do you know who that is? That's Gorlitz. That's, you know, the town of Jakob Burma. And their response was something like, hey, he's kind of a crazy man, kind of a madman, you know. So there's still a little bit of like this idea that he was, you know, he's kind of, I don't know if crazy is the right word, but like,
like a fool for Christ.
Yeah, something like that. Like he's somehow not fully with, you know, there's some kind of defect with him or something, you know, something that you can't just like accept him as like, and now he's great, you know, and now we're all going to have him be like part of the town, be known for it. I'm sure if you go to Gorlitz, yeah, there was a museum there and so forth. But he was, in a certain sense, he's quite radical in for this, that because his ideas were so challenging and and the way that he expressed them, he's a hard individual to categorize and to put somewhere, you know, that because he's shifty.
That we only had one book published in his lifetime. I mean, what were the others? Did he make up the others into manuscripts or?
No, I think he just had, I think he had lots of writings that were circulated, but I think they were made into manuscripts in Amsterdam, for example, and published elsewhere.
Who's the first person to do like correspondence courses
for us? Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. There's like secret writings. You also find a big tradition of this, you know, going on for a while of just circulation of teachings, you know, that had to be in a part of a private circle, you know, but these were the esoteric ideas. Or something. Yeah, so I mean he has books about like most famous book is Aurora. There's a book, The Confessions, that I mentioned, and there you get to see him struggling to overcome this lower part of this lowercase self, this darkness, and to, you know, reach this kind of chemical marriage within himself and to have this revelation. And he talks about how in some ways that had happened to him. Some of his other books talk about, there's some other things we didn't go into here because it's really just a lot, but he has some of his other texts talk about, there's one book, The Threefold Life, is kind of that's an interesting one. And then 40 Questions of the Soul. And some of these, he's, in the Book of the Three Principles, as I mentioned here, he does some of his like rereadings of biblical texts. Like I mentioned just a little bit of it with this rereading of the fall in the story of Genesis. But he also works out different types of systems. So like he has, and some people have argued like he might have been inspired by Kabbalah and the Sephiroth and the Tree of Life but it clearly looks like an alchemical because he's into astrology. So in some of these texts, he is like building correspondences between metals and planets and biblical symbolism and things like that. But then adding his own things, like one of the things, he's always adding this third principle. Like one of the things he's also known for is, I think, adding sulfur to the idea of salt and mercury, or that's the other way around. Like he's the one who puts salt, mercury, and sulfur together as being important, you know, and makes a big deal about that, and talks about that in a kind of alchemical way. But it's philosophical. He's not like in a laboratory or something. It's alchemically and astrology is inspiring his like philosophy. It's kind of like his spiritual philosophy, basically. So there's a lot of correspondences and a lot of like another thing he talks a lot about that we didn't quite cover is what he calls the seven spirits of God. And these are like different qualities that are like the means by which God exists or is active in creation, you know, and just to give an example of that, it's things like One is like sharpness or dryness or the power of contraction. Another one is sweetness or warmth. Another one is love. And so he builds up these qualities and how they interrelate. And it is very much about process and how through these processes of correspondences and interrelation, you know, different elements, different aspects of creation are manifest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which one of those books would you recommend for people to start with for Burma?
Yeah, well, you can just go read about the Ungrund if you want to have your mind spun around a bunch. But Aurora is a bit difficult, I would say, to start with. So, to be honest, I would say just look at the diagrams to start there that are associated with his writings, because there you can at least see visually depicted some of these ideas and start to get a sense about this idea of polarity and dialectic and third principle and three principles and so on. But there are the Confessions is the other one. You can find this online, actually. So, and this is just him talking about his life and his experiences. So it's also a bit more accessible. And the other one is that the one that was published in his life, The Way to Christ, there's a good edition of that by this, I think it's called the Classics in Western Spirituality series that most people are familiar, I think, with that. They did an edition of The Way to Christ, and they have some good commentary in there about what the idea is in there. And the other one is there's a smaller book that I quite liked, and it's from a series. It's an older book, but it's called the Esoteric Masters series. Can't remember who the compiler was, but they did a book on Burma also, which is, it's kind of edited, abridged compilation of some of his key writings, you know? So that one's also, I found quite good.
There's also the documentary film, which you recommend.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And there is a documentary now that is, it's in several languages. So if they have English subtitles, and it's on Vimeo, and it's called The Life and Legacy of Jacob Burma. And it's a documentary film by Lucas Chvalko, which I'm sure I'm saying his name wrong, and I apologize, but it's a really good documentary, really good introduction also to get like an overview of some of these ideas. And the last thing I wanted to mention is that because it's this 400th anniversary that you said at the beginning here, they're actually going to have a new exhibition in Gorlitz this year to commemorate that. And that, I think, is opening in August. So that's another thing to look out for.
All right. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add about Burma that is key? Or have we wrapped it up?
No, I think we did a good job of introducing him. There's obviously a lot more to talk about and a lot more depth and details and so forth. But I would just say that the more you dig into him, like, he's a bit hard to begin to start on, but the more you dig into it, the more like rewarding it is, I would say. So there are really good ideas in there, even ideas that are like in a meditative sense, that they really do cause you to think and to sort of go into contemplative states. And I think by reading him, you can really also see how important he was for modern esotericism.
All right. Well, I'll put the links for the things you mentioned in the description below. But it's a good place to finish up. So Aaron French, once again, thanks very much.
Thank you.